I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, it's time for some back talk. Your turn to tell us what you think about what we've been up to at Tell Me More. But first, it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about whatever's in the news and whatever's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs this week for a shape-up are freelance writer and reporter Jimmy Israel, editor and civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, political science professor Lester Spence, and reporter Howard Witt. I hear they have a lot to talk about, so let's get started, Jimmy.
Hey, hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey, how's it going?
Good morning.
All right, well, check this out. As we speak, busloads of protesters are descending on the Department of Justice to protest what they see as the federal government's refusal to prosecute some racial incidents as hate crimes. Now, they're talking about those nooses hung in Jena, Louisiana, as well as some hung on college campuses, and the alleged torture of a West Virginia woman by a group of whites. Now, the march was called for by civil rights advocates such as Reverend Al Sharpton and Martin Luther King III. Also, Michael Bazin was one of the. He's a local. He's not local. He's a national radio host. He also had this call. We got a clip here, Michelle.
Well, yeah, we were able to talk to Lisa Crigson. She's a counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice, and we thought it was only fair to ask the Department of Justice what they thought about the complaint being leveled at them. And this is what she said.
In looking at one of the areas of our enforcement, which is color of law or police misconduct type cases, in the past 6 years, we have increased the number of cases that have been brought by 50% over the previous 6 years. In looking at nearly all of the benchmarks of how the Civil Rights Division is aggressively enforcing the law, our record is something that we're very proud of.
So, Arsalan, do you mind if I ask you? You're the civil rights guy in the House, civil rights lawyer. What do you think? Did she make a compelling argument? Is the Justice Department doing its job?
Well, you know, the Justice Department is obviously going to tout its efforts, but I think that, you know, they have really not done enough in terms of prosecuting hate crimes. I think something important to keep in mind, whether it's the Jena 6 case or the case in West Virginia, it's federal prosecutors in those states that have to bring the federal hate crimes charges. It's a less decentralized system than, you know, coming from the Department of Justice here. Now, it was interesting to hear Lisa talk about the color of law and police brutality cases, but she specifically did not mention hate crime prosecutions. And so I think that, you know, being a civil rights lawyer after 9/11, you know, I think the Justice Department has not done enough in terms of prosecuting hate crimes.
Jimmy, what do you think?
Arsalan, what even constitutes a hate crime?
Well, that's a very good question, Jimmy. Under federal statutes, basically any bias-motivated assault or battery is considered a hate crime. So that's why it makes it a little more difficult to prosecute hate crimes, because essentially you would need a sort of racial epithet to be yelled during an assault, or, you know, just a spray painting something on a wall might not constitute a technical hate crime. During the actual commission of a crime, there has to be a clear bias motivation, and that's what makes it a lot of times difficult to prosecute.
Yeah, there's another twist. This is Howard. I'm going to jump in for a second. The federal law is very narrow because they can only get involved on a federal level if someone's civil rights were violated in the course of doing a federally protected action, mm-hmm. i.e. if they were voting or attending school or trying to get housing. That narrows very significantly the number of cases that federal law even allows the authorities to get involved in. So that's a real constraint.
And I just want to point out here, Howard's been covering this issue closely. He's reported on the Jena 6 case closely. He's also reported on a number of issues throughout the Southwest. He works for the Chicago Tribune, but he works in the Southwest. I just thought I'd throw that out.
Also, Howard, you've been looking into this march in D.C. today. They're calling this kind of Jena 6 Part 2. And you've been looking into some behind-the-scenes struggle that's going on. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, there's an interesting backstory going on with this march today, because basically what you're looking at is a struggle between the old guard or the new guard over who's going to kind of lead the new civil rights movement in the 21st century. The Jena March, which was so large and so widespread, was largely driven by African-American bloggers and, to a lesser extent, African-American talk radio hosts. And it was only after there was a real ferment in the blogosphere over the Jena story that people like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson and the rest of the mainstream leaders jumped in on that, and then they kind of you know, attracted the TV cameras. So now this time Sharpton's having this march in Washington, and he specifically has excluded the internet netizens and the blogosphere, and they've been grumbling that they have not been included in this. So it's kind of a test, I think, for Sharpton to see what kind of a turnout he can do if he does it the old way and if he relies on his own network rather than trying to reach out to this kind of new age network. So it'll be interesting.
Lester, I know you got something to say.
Yeah, and first of all, I want to really give a shout-out to Howard, because Howard Witt, I actually blogged about Shaquanda Cotton and, to a lesser extent, Jenna 6. Howard Witt was the one who actually brought this to our attention, and when I was giving him a shout-out on my own blog, I actually thought he was black just because, you know, very rarely do you see white journalists deal with these issues. So I just want to get that out there. But the thing is...
Thank you, Lester. That was very kind of you.
Oh, yeah.
Good. Howard unmasked.
He's been passing. The thing is that it's not about... Where Howard is wrong is that these type of marches, they're not part of strategies. They're really tactics. And when you're talking about, well, who's going to lead the new civil rights movement, what that really gets us away from is how do we get the Justice Department to move on issues dealing with social justice specifically and racial justice in general. And marches don't do anything for that. All they do is increase the number of stories, and then they allow people like Al Sharpton to consider themselves as black leaders because they had a lot of people at a march. And to the extent that we can talk about whether it's bloggers versus Al Sharpton doing it, we really move beyond. We're stuck in a 60s argument that didn't even work in the 60s. And that's important to say.
Jimmy, I'm really going to hear what you have to say on this.
Ask you? For me, I'm not even sure Al Sharpton is even relevant anymore. You know, I mean, a lot of the power struggle behind the scenes suggests to me what this is really about. It's about leveraging camera time, you know, in an attempt to solidify Sharpton's leadership status and to kind of coordinate, you know, Michael Bazden. You know, he's looking for that coordination. You know, his picture with Al Sharpton is prominently featured on his website. You know, and I'm not biting. This is the same cat that hosts a radio show called Love, Lust, and Lies that really just kind of specializes in randy relationships talk. Now, all of a sudden, he's leading marches for justice. I'm not biting.
Grown folks radio.
So I take it you're not on a bus.
I am not on the bus, sister. Not today.
Okay. All right. Well, I just wanted to check, make sure you weren't on the bus. But I got to ask you about this whole Barry Bonds situation. This federal grand jury indicted Bonds on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. And I don't know. I'm just dying to know what you guys think about that. Arslan?
Lester.
Oh, Lester.
Oh,
okay.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Lester.
Lester, is this going to affect his legacy?
Oh, yeah. But the thing is it's already been tainted because the media doesn't really – media personalities – and I really wish Ralph Wiley, he was a sports columnist, like the best sports columnist I've ever read. I wish he was alive to actually write about this. But media personalities in general don't like Barry Bonds, and they never have. So this is just another nail in the coffin. And it's unfortunate that made Barry Bonds one of the best baseball players ever is the thing that's going to bring him down. And I wouldn't be surprised if he served time, although I don't really think he should.
Arslan, what do you think?
Well, the ironic thing is I have the indictment here right in front of me, and here he was given all immunity from any criminal prosecution except for perjury. And so he was an idiot for then lying. Basically, they said, you can tell the truth. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be prosecuted for any of it. But he had to go and shoot himself in the foot. He already knew that people were after him. I mean, his records were already tainted by what he was saying in the press. And this is just going to perpetuate the notion that, you know, he's a prima donna who has been lying about this. And it's going to be the Mark McGuire syndrome all over again. There's always going to be, you know, an asterisk or just a general
taint. But isn't the question with him whether he knew that what he was taking was a banned substance? I mean, isn't that the crux of the matter with him, whether you believe him or not?
Right. The crux of the matter, based on the indictment, is whether or not he willfully lied to a grand jury. And they specifically cited questions where he was asked, did you ever take steroids? And he flatly said no on several occasions. And so obviously the federal prosecutors are going to have some sort of evidence, at least they think, that is going to prove that he knew that what he was taking was steroids.
Wow. Jimmy, what do you think?
I think it's the end of the baseball hero. I mean, it's been coming for some time. But I think, again, you know, as L. Spence says, you know, this is kind of the nail in the coffin. I mean, you know, our kids should be looking up to sports heroes anyway, but now we know that they can't for sure. You know, and Howard, you know, I was curious, do you think he should even be in the Hall of Fame after this?
No, I don't see how. I mean, you know, Michelle said the question comes down to whether he knew he was taking a banned substance. The question is, what was he taking anything for? You know, I mean, how are you supposed to explain to your kids, well, he might have been taking something, but it was, you know, might have been okay. I mean, that's shades of gray there that just shouldn't even exist. You don't take anything.
You take pills for headaches, don't you, Howard?
What's that?
Don't you take pills for headaches?
Well, I do take pills for headaches.
Yeah, he doesn't take pills to make his head grow, though.
He does. Barry Bonds got the biggest head I've ever seen.
I'm so tempted to make a cheap joke about Jimmy, but I think I'll refrain because it's almost holiday. I have just restrained myself in view of the fact that it's almost holiday. Can I just ask a quick question about speaking of people who are a headache? This whole Stephon Marbury situation and Isaiah Thomas. Well, Stephon Marbury's threatening to tell tales out of school about his coach because should Thomas just dump him?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, when your star player who makes $29 million a year is acting like a little school child saying, if you don't start me, I'm going to tattle on you. I mean, that just shows that this guy should not be a part of the New York Knicks any longer.
Other folks? What do other people think?
Well, Marbury's got skills on the court, but he just doesn't have leadership. And this is just another example where what really happened is he didn't say this to the press. He said this to one of his boys, and one of his boys reported it to the press. He should have kept his mouth shut for two reasons. One, because it hurts the game. But the second is that, and I'm a longtime Isaiah Thomas supporter because I was born and raised in Detroit, Isaiah Thomas is gangster. And he's not going to win that fight. I mean, there's at no level is he going to win that fight. Isaiah is gangster.
Okay.
Yeah, I got to co-sign that. And, you know, besides the fact that Marbury has those ugly shoes, he's got those weak knees. He needs to stop. He needs to keep his mouth shut and get in the gym and get his knees right.
I like those shoes.
Not for $12. No, I can't
do it. I like those shoes. Howard, final thought from you about Stephon? Stay or go?
The next step in that case should be a grand jury and perjury charges.
Wow. Ouch. Ouch. Well, it's almost Thanksgiving, and before I let you all go, I have to say one of the things I'm thankful for is the fellas that they come in every week and tell us what's on the guys' minds, such as it is.
And we're thankful for you, Michelle.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you all. Jimmy Israel joined us from WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida. He's a freelance writer and reporter. Lester Spence is an assistant political science professor at Johns Hopkins University. That would be Dr. Lester Spence to you. He joined us from WYPR in Baltimore. Arsalan Iftikhar is a contributing editor for Islamica magazine. He was here with us in our studio in Washington, and on the phone with us from Texas was Howard Witt, Southwest Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune. You can find links to all of our barbershop guests at our website, npr.org/tellmemore. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michelle.
Sure.
Thanks for having me.
Yep, yep.